seems strange. It's narrow and long. So, can you hear? Well, it is nice to be here for another teen prom. I never had one when I was in high school, so I'm glad to be a part of this on your behalf. The people here have worked hard. As we say, it works because we make it work. Well, I don't know what I did to make it work, but it will work because many here have been working hard to make sure that it does work. Yogi Berra became a legendary catcher for the New York Yankees baseball team from 1946 to about 1963. Yogi became well known for his many humorous witticisms, which he acquired along the road of life, and he also gained experience along that road in what to do and what not to do as a catcher and as a man. One of Yogi's famous sayings was, "He's learning me all his experience." And he said that about Bill Dickey, who had been the catcher for the Yankees before that. He was an outstanding catcher, and he taught Berra many of the good points on being a good catcher. Another one of Yogi's witticisms was, "If you don't know where you're going, you might not get there." Another one was, "You can observe a lot by watching." And another one, with a little different word, was, "The future ain't what it used to be." Obviously, Yogi needed a little help with English. He quit school around the eighth grade, but he was a very, very good talker. One of his most famous witticisms was, and this is the essence of the sermon this afternoon, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." Take it. That statement has already been made into a book. You can buy that at Amazon.com if you wanted to read it, or you can also read it on your Kindle if you want to do that. In the book, Yogi said, "Throughout life, you come to serious forks in the road where you have to make decisions. Which path do you choose? Sometimes it's tough," he said. "People are always afraid of making the wrong choice." And it is true. Many young people today have come to a fork in the road of life, and they made a wrong choice. They made a wrong turn. Why was that? Well, it wasn't, and we usually think, oh, they were just punks, you know, they deserve what they got. But that wasn't the reason. It wasn't because they were evil, nor was it because they were unfit for life. It was because they had no personal experience on that road before. You think that through, that's a big reason for a lot of our difficulties. We have had no experience on that road before, and no one had taken the time to tell them how to navigate the road. They were left on their own. They didn't just know from personal experience, nor from anyone teaching them how to navigate that road, or, as we say, which fork to take. It was a humorous incident in the ministry of DeLee and me in the times we were in Mississippi in the 60s. I'd ask a lady if we could visit her at her home. And she said, "Well, yeah, that'd be fine." So I said, "Well, how do we find your home?" Because I'd never been there before. She said, "Head south on the state highway. When you come to the first cedar tree, turn right and come straight out on the road to my home." Well, it sounded easy, very easy. I did take the state highway, and I did find the cedar tree. Thankfully, I knew what a cedar tree was at that time. Excuse me. I turned right on the road, but that road was anything but straight. It had a lot of twists and turns. And we, that is, DeLee and I, kept on the road. And we finally did, after many twists and turns, find the home. And it was then, after the fact, that I finally understood what she meant or was trying to tell me. And that was, once you get on the road, don't ever get off the road. Good instructions, too. In the Bible, you'll find that God says that we, the parents, should be teaching our children. And it is true that parents should teach their children which fork to take, maybe even at the table sometimes, but on the road of life, which fork to take. But often they just don't get around to it. There are other things that take up their time, and they don't get around to telling their children, informing their children, encouraging their children to take the right road. Quite often they are too busy in the rush of life with the need to buy food, to pay bills, take care of other things that are pressing in their life. And so the children and which road to take just get kind of overlooked. One thing I remember in my life as a teenager, along that point, about that point, in the summer of 1953 on our farm home front porch in West Texas, my father and mother were talking about Vernon. I don't know what they were saying because I wasn't close enough to hear, nor I didn't think I wanted to know what they were saying either, but they were talking about me. And my father said to my mother, "Leave him alone. When he's 21, he'll know what to do." Well, sad to say, I had a lot to learn. Quite a few times, I came to a fork in the road, and I didn't take the proper turn. I didn't take the correct fork. Life is choices, and I didn't always make the correct choice. If we have prior knowledge of what to do and how to do it from a parent or a friend or a book, it would help us as children, as youth. I say us, because I'm still a youth in a sense. Like to think I am anyway. If we had prior knowledge from a parent, a friend, or a book, it would help us immensely. That's where Yogi Berra's witticisms came in. As I said, they're now in a book, and they are good, and they're very helpful. But there is a better book for youth than the one that Yogi put together. You probably know what I'm talking about, but there's a book that has been deliberately and specifically produced, and this is the important and wonderful part about it. It was produced with a forethought and kindness toward young people. Often we may think, as we read it, that somebody's out to clobber us over the head to make us hurt. But it was produced with a forethought and kindness toward young people. The book is written for those who are approaching that fork in the road. And its main purpose is to help those young people who might be wondering, as often they are, how can I know which fork to take? And should I take it? Or should I not take it? You'll find, I'm sure you've found, as I've found in my life, and I'm sure you as teenagers will also be finding, that many decisions are made based on personal feelings. Does it feel good? This is a feel-good time of history, shall we say. If it satisfies their feelings, nothing wrong with it. It's not a sin because it makes me feel good. Well, you'll find that many people look upon Proverbs as a religious book. Religion. We don't want anything of religion. We want life. And so they think of the Proverbs book as a religious book. Well, it's anything but a religious book, especially in the light of what religion really is. Proverbs is a book about common sense information. You might want to think about those words. Common sense, you would think it would be common sense information that will lead, and this is the very important part, that will lead the inexperienced. Now, I know we all like to think we know it all. We know it all. Nobody can tell us anything. That we know it all and nobody can do anything for us. But deep down inside, we know that we are inexperienced on some things, maybe many things. We've never done it. We've not had any experience. So we are the inexperienced. And so this book is a common sense information book that will lead the inexperienced to a very, very good way of life. a little redundant. Reading Proverbs can help the inexperienced to operate like they've had years of good experience. I remember many years ago a man who grew up in Southern California. I think he went to UCLA. He was a really outstanding track runner. He knew a lot of the Hollywood actors and actresses. He was a man of great experience, and he was a member of the church I pastored. And one day he said, "Where did you get all that wisdom?" Well, it shocked me that I had wisdom. But to him, for what he had gone through, what I was showing him was wisdom. And I said, "I got it from Proverbs." I don't know if you ever read it or not, but so be it. Proverbs can help the inexperienced to operate as if they've had many years of good experience. All they have to do is read and heed. You may have heard of this man. He's a multimillionaire by now. Stephen Scott wrote the book, The Richest Man Who Ever Lived. Small book, but it's very powerful in its content and very helpful to youth or to anybody, really. It was all about the knowledge that can be gleaned from Proverbs, his book was. He had to put a racy title in there like The Richest Man Who Ever Lived. I think a more appealing subtitle was Secrets. And everybody loves a secret. You know, if you've got a secret, you know what others don't know. So it was about secrets to success, wealth, and happiness. Scott graduated from Arizona State University in Tempe, I think around 1970. But in 1974, after only 4 years out of college, he lost his sixth job since he had graduated from college. He just couldn't keep a job, and he didn't understand why. It just didn't make any sense to him, and he just couldn't somehow seem to make life work. Well, Gary Smalley was visiting him in Scottsdale one evening, and Scott asked Smalley if he might be able to offer any suggestions on how to get a job and hold a job, because he was absolutely frustrated. He was married, and he wasn't able to make a living. So rather than answering the problem or answering the question immediately, which it's not always the best thing to do to answer it immediately when you haven't heard the full story, Smalley asked for some time to think about it. And the next morning, after praying about it, about the problem, Smalley asked Scott, and this dumbfounded Scott, Smalley said, "How would you like to be smarter than all of your bosses?" Well, he wasn't worrying about being smart. He wanted a job. But Smalley said, "How would you like to be smarter than all of your bosses?" Well, Scott was a little bit cynical. He more or less said, "Yeah, tell me another one." But Smalley said, "No. If you'll do just one thing within 2 years, you'll be smarter than all of your future bosses. If you will read one chapter of Proverbs every day for 1 month, and then do that month after month for 2 years, you'll be smarter than your bosses. And if you do it for 5 years, you might even become a millionaire." Scott didn't have anything to lose. So, you know, he had nothing to lose, so he read the Proverbs as he'd been told. A chapter each day, took 31 days, 31 chapters. And then month after month, he read that. He read it as he had been told, and within 2 years, he found a business partner, which is what really helped him, and he was on his way. I think he's now probably a multimillionaire. Multimillionaire when he couldn't keep a job. Lost six jobs, 4 years in a row, you might say, out of a very top quality college, university. If parents don't teach the Proverbs to their children as a way of life, not as a religious book, but as a way of life, a way of living life, all a child has to do is read himself the principles found in this book of wisdom. If he has the wisdom and the strength and the stick-to-itiveness to do it, because it is not religion. It is not religion, although it speaks of religion in a sense. But it's not religion. It's common sense principles about a way of life, which is the best way of life. And often teenagers leave and they say, I don't want this religion anymore. I want life. Well, Proverbs speaks about life a lot and how to make sure that you will have a good life. So let's look now at a few items listed in the book or this book. We'll hit a few highlights. I wanted to make a statement first about it. The essence of all that is written in this book, Proverbs, the essence of all that is written in this book is what the choice or the decision should be and what fork to take. What the decision should be and what the fork in the road should be that you would take. Let me repeat that again to you. The essence of all that is written in the book of Proverbs is what the choice or decision should be and what fork in the road should be taken. Let's go to the book of Proverbs, chapter 1, and we'll find a little bit about these principles that lead us to a wonderful way of life. In chapter 1, the first two verses, in essence, it is saying that we as young people, or we as people, need to get a firm hold on wisdom, and wisdom is the ability to make wise choices. To get a firm hold on wisdom, instruction, and understanding, it says in verse 2, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding. And then verse 3 talks about having the ability or the willingness to actually accept what is right. It's one thing to read it, it's another thing to accept it. In verse 3 it says to receive the instruction of wisdom. Yogi Berra said, he's learning me this experience, all that he knows. Well, he accepted what he was told by that man who was a catcher, a good catcher, and he listened to what was told him, and he became a very, very outstanding catcher in Major League Baseball. So it's not just a matter of reading it, it's the ability of getting a firm hold on wisdom, instruction, and understanding, and being willing to accept what is truly right. Then in verse 4, it talks about prudence, simple, and discretion. Prudence, and this may sound strange because it says that Satan is more subtle, or the snake that was in the garden, shall we say, as they say, was more subtle than any other. Subtle means deceitful, but it just means having the ability to see through it all and to know what to do. It said to give prudence, which could mean subtlety, that is, being able to see through everything and know what should be done, and also to the simple. I don't think any of us really want to think, oh, I'm just a simple person. No, but it means those who are simplistic in life, but it also can mean, simple can mean silly. And so it says to give prudence to the silly who aren't serious about certain things. And to the young person, knowledge, which is data, you might say, knowledge and discretion. They do sound very religious, but knowledge and discretion. Discretion means a plan. Young people need to have a plan. They need to have a plan. So knowledge and discretion, or a plan by the young person on what should I do and how should I do it. The essence, I think, of the whole book is in verse 7, which says, and this is the, I guess you might say, sad word that is used, the fear of God. And often, I must acknowledge, in the Church of God, and many ministers have, I'm going to strike the fear of God in you. Well, that's not exactly what this fear means. It means respect. You probably have people you know that you respect because of the way they live, and you wish you could be that way. Well, God is the most respectable being of all, and because of his ability to do things that are cataclysmic can be, yeah, there should be times when maybe we should actually even fear God, that is, challenge him, and think that we might win in one way or another. The essence is in verse 7, the fear or respect for God is the beginning or the largest part of knowledge. So respect for the righteous God and his perfect ways is the essence of it all. And the latter part, or in verse 8, it also gives another important part. It talks about the instruction of your father, jokingly, the law of your mother. The law of the mother, she will tell you. So the essence is to respect God, to follow his ways, and to respect or honor the parents, your parents, who gave you life. Where would we be if they hadn't given us life? We wouldn't be. It's a marvelous, wonderful blessing to be alive. And God, our father and mother gave us this opportunity. Now, maybe we don't like the circumstances, but that's beside the point. Without their giving us life, we would not have life. So we stand here with a wonderful opportunity because of them. I never asked my parents if I was planned or I was an oops. I never bothered to ask that. I was just happy to be alive and a part of the family. Then in verse 8, two words are given that show how God views the uninitiated, the simple, the naive, a youth, a teen. Verse 8, the first two verses says, my son. My son. Notice he didn't say, knothead. He didn't say, idiot. He didn't say, stupid. He said, my son, my son that I love dearly. Two very simple words. And you will find, I think, upwards of 25 or more times in the book of Proverbs that it says, my son. Never once does he say, you idiot. He speaks very lovingly and gently to his children, his son, his daughter. Then you'll find in verse 10 begins the what if situations to his sons that he loves. And they're always what if situations. What if such and such happens? Then what do you do? What if such and such doesn't happen? Then what do you do? So verse 10 starts the what if scenario in life. He said, my son, if, so there are always ifs in life, if sinners entice you. So what's a sinner? Might be wealthy, might be well educated, but he's not living by God's laws and he's trying to prove to you you shouldn't either. If sinners entice you, those would be those who are living outside the laws of God. If they try to entice you, God says to a son, don't consent. Simple answer, don't consent. If they say, come with us, we're going to really make it. If they're not living by God's laws, somewhere along the line, they will mess up. Those two who bombed Boston learned that They were not trying to live by God's ways. They were trying to destroy other people. Apparently, the older encouraged the younger. They both now, one lost his life, the other may. If sinners try to entice you or lead you along to begin living as they do, and you know they're not living by God's truth laws, it just simply says don't consent. Why not? What's wrong with that? Well, you'll find in verse 19 a very simple answer. The bottom half of verse 19 says, it takes away the life of the owner. Or, better stated, it will take away the quality of a good life. It may not take your life, but it will take away the quality that we could have had. Then in verse 20, it mentions wisdom calling. Now, wisdom is not an individual. It's not an actual person. But it said wisdom calls aloud as if it were a person. And when it says aloud, or also she raises her voice in the open squares, you know, sometimes we think, well, I didn't know. When it says wisdom calls aloud, and raises her voice in the open squares, meaning where people are. This shows that the answer, if we want an answer, if we want to do the right thing, the answer for right choices is available almost anywhere if we really want it. There are books on almost everything that we need to work on. Wisdom calls, if. Then in verse 29 to 31, you'll find moment. Yep. It talks about their, they did not choose the fear of God. That is a choice. We don't just fall into it. We do have to choose. If they do not choose the right fork, they will suffer the consequences. And in verse 31, it says they shall eat the fruit or results of their own way. Now, that's one of the hardest things in life to accept and to swallow, that we're suffering from consequences. We are suffering from what we have done. We are experiencing cause and effect, sowing and reaping. And so, we have to realize there are choices made. In chapter 2, it also says in verse 1, if you receive my words, that means that we listen to God's words and we follow them, and you treasure my commands. In other words, if we understand that it is a choice and we make that choice, then in verse 11, discretion will preserve you. So this is in the connection with receiving God's words, listening to the right instructions. If we do that, it says in verse 11, discretion will preserve you. I've heard some say that they feel like they have been preserved as they lived life as a teenager, that things worked out so that they were actually preserved or saved or rescued. It said, if you live by my ways, the right ways, and make the right choices, then you will be preserved. Not like apple preserves, but you will be saved from difficulties. And it says that it will keep you. Then in verse 12, there's a very important point. And it said, this will preserve you and keep you. And it says, to deliver you from. And there are times, I guess, when we all need to be delivered from certain situation that we may have fallen into. But it said that you will be delivered, and it lists two particular things or pitfalls in life that you would be delivered from. The latter part of verse 12 says, from the evil, from No, verse 12, the latter part of that sentence says, from the way of evil. And the latter part of that sentence says, from the man who speaks perverse things. So, first and foremost, we will be delivered from evil people who leave the right path. You'll be delivered from following the follower. And then you'll find in verse 16 that it says, to deliver you from the immoral woman. In other words, delivered from the bad things of life. We will be delivered from those things that are very easy to fall into, to following an evil individual who's makes no bones about not living by God's ways and wants to entice us and bring us along with him too. And also from a woman who, for whatever reason, is an immoral woman who can convince individuals to do things they should not ought to do. To deliver you from the seductress who flatters with her words, and men are famously known for giving in to flattery. We all know that there are some pretty disastrous things in life that can ruin our lives. Drugs, cheating, stealing, immoral action. And once we fall into that, it changes the entire course of our life. And life will never be the same after we make that choice. We may come away from it, but we have all those things to remember and wish that we hadn't done that. Chapter 3 also says, don't forget my law. That, I guess, is the hard one sometimes. What it means really is, always remember the right way of life. Always remember the right rules. It said, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep them. As I jokingly say sometimes, not just the notes you took at church, but in the heart. That is something that we have imbibed, that we have brought into our very life. It's part and parcel of us. Remember the right rules and keep them in your heart. And why? Well, it said if you want to have length of days and long life. Now, length of days may not mean 365 days and many, many more years after that. It could mean not have to redo the mess we've made, and you lengthen your life in that way. You have a longer, easier life because you don't have to undo or redo all the mess we made before. So by forgetting our law, God's laws, we can have a shortened life, and by living those laws or remembering them or putting them in our heart, we don't have to redo a lot of things that we would have done, and we have a longer life. Length of days and long life. I used to say, when I retire, if I ever retire at 70, I got to live another 70 years. They always said, why? I said, I need 70 more years to actually learn and imbibe what I merely heard the first 70. And I still say that from time to time. Chapter 4, you will find in verse 23 a very, very, very important point about life. Chapter 4. And this is an extremely important one for youth. And it's still good for old people too. Chapter 4 and verse 23. Keep, and this is the New King James Version, keep your heart with all diligence. That's the both in the Old King James and New King James, keep your heart. The word means guard. Guard. Stand guard at your heart. It also means to protect. It also means to maintain. Now, why do we need to do that? It gives the answer. It said, for out of it springs the issues of life. What we've put into our heart will affect the things we do in life that make our life. So keep or guard or maintain our heart with diligence. Because if we don't, we could fall into almost anything. This proverb, "Keep your heart with all diligence," gives a guideline that helps us to grow up with more choices and fewer regrets. Fewer regrets. Let me state that again. I speak from experience. You probably can see it clearly. This proverb, "Guard your heart with all diligence," gives a guideline that helps us grow up, or mature, shall we say, with more good choices and fewer regrets. Recently at one of the teen speech clubs here in Columbus at a recent meeting, the question was asked, "Do you think kissing before marriage was allowed in biblical times?" Well, I didn't live back there, so I really didn't know from personal experience. It was said almost everyone accepts the idea of kissing before marriage today. Do you think it's a good one? There were a lot of differing answers among the teens. So later I talked to them about it this way. First of all, what kind of kiss are you talking about? You mean there's more than one different kind? What kind of kiss are we talking about? You're talking about a kiss on the forehead, a kiss on the cheek, on or in the mouth, swapping spit, in the clinch. You didn't know there were so many different kisses, did you? So what kind of kiss are we talking about? Why are we doing it? Is it lust, which is a sin, the tenth of the ten? Is it an itch that we feel that we must satisfy at all costs? It might be something that will be regretted and can never be undone, or lead to things that could never be undone. I mentioned to them, talk with your parents. Remember, one of the laws says, honor your parents. Get to know your parents. Ask their input on it. True it is, and it really is true, that kissing is a sign of affection. But what many young people and many older people don't know is that boys and girls, men and women, don't look on kissing and other things the same way. They look at it differently. I don't know if I shocked anybody when I said God is not against kissing. It depends on what kind of kissing we're involved in. Four times in the New Testament, not the Old, but in the New Testament. In the New Testament, four times it speaks of a holy kiss. Now, how many of you know what a holy kiss is? Have you ever had a holy kiss? Have you ever given a holy kiss? You probably have and just didn't know it. Four times it says, speaking of church members, two church members, greet one another with a holy kiss. What in the world is a holy kiss? Well, it means physically pure, morally blameless. It means wholesome. It means appropriate. It means something you're not going to have to be ashamed or embarrassed of, or try to get rid of the other things that happened because of the unholy kiss. Then I revealed a little bit about Delee and me as we dated. Delee kissed me before we were married. She beat me to the punch, though. Delee kissed me before we were married. I proposed, she had accepted, and we were engaged. We were planning to get married. And it was some time later, we were walking in the lower garden at the Ambassador College in Pasadena. And we sat down in that area. And I leaned over to kiss her. And she stiffened like a board. And I thought, what in the world is wrong with me? I was shocked that when I was about to give her a kiss, she just turned like a stiff board. Was there something wrong? Well, what I didn't see that she saw was the night watchman was walking right up to us. The night watchman was walking in the gardens also, and he was trying to find students doing things they shouldn't do. She went ahead and kissed me, and it was very wholesome. He never said a word. So the Bible says, guard your heart. Protect your heart. Don't just throw it out there and let it get broken. How many songs have you heard about the broken heart and the difficulties of life because of a broken heart? Well, how do you get a broken heart? You throw it out there and let it get stomped on. You don't guard it. That's one of the difficulties of the teen life. They haven't understood that principle. Guard your heart. Don't just throw it out there. Because someone will take advantage. And your heart will get broken. As I said, if you don't believe that, listen to the many, many songs that talk about the broken heart. Why should we guard our heart? Well, it said, out of it are the issues of life. Or the important parts of life, dating, marriage, whether or not to have children, a career, wealth. Good decisions from the heart make a very big, big, big difference in life. Then you'll find in chapter 8 that it says in verse 32. Listen to me, my children. Listen, he said. Listen to me, my children. And he said, blessed are those who keep my ways. Now, that's a promise. But we have to prove it by following what he says. And then in verse 36, you will find that the opposite is given where it says, he who sins or breaks the law wrongs his own soul, his own body, his own life. It's very depressing and discouraging to experience sowing and reaping, cause and effect. But it is an absolute that nobody can get away with. In chapter 9, it talks about wisdom building her home in verse 1. And then skipping down to verse 4. It says, whoever is simple, let him turn in here. Now, simple could mean naive or silly or he's not allowed anybody to learn him the simplicities of life. The simple, as I said, can mean naive. And it said, as for him who lacks understanding, come, it says, eat and drink. Eat my bread, drink my wine. Forsake foolishness and live. As I said, Proverbs is not a religion. It is a common sense book. It is a book of common sense principles that offer a way of life, actually the best way of life. One of the Proverbs you read of answers the question as to why so many teens grow up, get married, and have very little in life. And they live not too much of an enjoyable life in one sense for years. You'll find this in Proverbs 21 and verse 20. Proverbs 21 and verse 20 says, there is desirable treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise. In other words, those who are wise, they will have a lot. They will have a good life. But a foolish person squanders it. Meaning they are living paycheck to paycheck, as I put it in modern English. Why are so many who have had great desire and rushed into life and yet in their middle ages find they're just living paycheck to paycheck to paycheck to paycheck? Why? Well, apparently they came to a fork in the road and they took the wrong fork. They spent instead of saving. They spent and spent and spent instead of saving. If we never learn to save, I don't see how we can ever have a very good life, because it says that money answers all things. And if you're living above your income, as we say, overspending, then you're living paycheck to paycheck, and you can never advance that way. It takes maturity, and there are three principles that lead to maturity. One is knowledge, which is correct data. Correct data, which makes possible skillful living when you have the right information. Then there comes understanding, which means they have a grasp of what the data means. And when we have a grasp of what the data means, we can discern lessons about life, and we can distinguish between the permanent values of life and those that lead to immediate gratification. Understanding. Oh, I see now. And then comes wisdom, the ability to make that wise choice. Wisdom leads to these correct choices and decisions, which, of course, then leads to a really good life. One of the questions that I ask myself sometimes, still do, and I know that people ask, is, well, why doesn't God do something for me or about this problem? Why doesn't he solve this for me? The answer is simple, and it is in the first or second chapter of the Bible, God's approach. God never solves our problems for us. One of the mistakes we made as young ministers was we tried to live people's lives and force them into certain things and make them do certain things. We did it for them, and you might say, and we did that in child rearing. God never solves our problems for us. He never steps in and forces us to choose the correct fork. I know when I read in Genesis where he had said to Adam and Eve, you know, don't take the eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He disappeared. And Eve went to the tree and ate some of it. Now, if I had been God, I would have been standing there looking around the corner. And as soon as I saw her taking the first move, I would have said, no, you can't do that. I won't let you. But he didn't stop her. And he let her. And they learned. God does not stop us. He lets us make the choice. He simply informs us of the correct principles that will correct the problem. And we then have to make the decision to live by those. And then the problem is solved. Just like that, almost sometimes. There really isn't a huge number of correct principles to follow. Just a few, like respect for God, respect for parents. And the one that gets many into problems is avoid porneia, that is, sexual immorality, the evil, immoral man and the evil, immoral woman, and then living by the Ten Commandments. But you'll find in the Bible that God speaks to young people with affection. My son, my daughter, my beloved child. Why does he do it that way? Because he wants them to grow up and have success in life. Now and all during their life. But life is full of choices. We must know how to choose and how to make good decisions. So remember, as Yogi said, when you come to a fork in the road, I've added, you must think seriously about what is the right thing to do. Seriously about the right fork to take. Proverbs were written for us, and it can help us do that. Speaking of forks, I'm reminded of a story about an elderly lady. She called her pastor and asked if he would come and visit her. He did. She said, I need to talk with you. So they sat and talked, in her small living room for a long time. She shared with them that she'd been told by doctors that she probably had only about 6 months to live because of a previously undetected tumor. As usual, which is par for the course, he began to say, "Oh, I'm so sorry to," and she said, "Don't be. I'm not afraid to die." She wanted to talk to him about her funeral. And they talked for a long time. Finally, she said, "There's one more thing I want to tell you about it. When they bury me, I want my old Bible in one hand and a fork in the other hand." He said, "A fork? Why?" She said, she talked about church dinners, banquets, home meals that she attended over the many years. One thing that stuck in her mind, she said, was that those nice get-togethers and meals, when the meal was almost finished, a host or a server would come, and when they came to collect the dirty dishes. But sometimes at these best ones, somebody would lean over her shoulder and whisper, "You can keep your fork. You can keep your fork." When they told me I could keep my fork, I knew the best was yet to come. And then she said to her minister, "That's exactly what I want people to talk about at my funeral. When they walk by my casket and look at my pretty blue dress, I want them to turn to one another and say, 'Why the fork?' I want you to tell them that I kept the fork because the best was yet to come." So, to sum it all up, somewhere along the road of life, there will be many forks in that road of life. And the forks, of course, are indicative of decisions that must be made. So when we encounter that fork, or forks, and there will be forks in the road, smile big time. Breathe deeply of the wonderfully clean, fresh, sweet, aromatic air. At a fork in the road, why? Because we, like the older lady, will know that if we take the right fork, the correct fork, in the road of life, there will be many, many, many good things that await us in life.